Blog Talk Radio.
If you've reached the, you ever reached that point where you just find that you need a bit of a refresh. That it's not that there's a, life is wearing more heavily on you, but you're noticing things differently. If you're a bit weary, a bit tired actually, it's easier to. Notice the tedium in things, particularly it happens when we let our minds wander a bit. It sounds kind of strange or simplistic to say, as long as you stay focused and you're in your own manner. If you do tasks as if your duties in your day as if they're a burden, you might want to revisit that and ask yourself what in the world has made your life and the things that you do, your normal routine, a burden. And that's not natural, and it's not you at all. You weren't born that way, were you? No. Even if we were treated that way as boys, as many of us were, you have duty and obligation and assignment. Someone else would tell you, always be telling you what you ought to do and when you ought to do it. But there comes that time that, I don't know, that liberation when you finally have the freedom to make your own choices. And that's not always easy for people. So some are, as we know, some compensate. Freedom at last. Let's go just crazy and wild. And in North America, that's been a prevalent attitude to really treat youth as an irrelevance. You don't have any bearing or any purpose, so fill it in with whatever manner you can and try not to hurt yourself. And if you do it privately, try not to embarrass your family or your neighbors, those kind of things. So that's a different kind of community than the one I'm talking about. I'm talking about this more mature kind of a sense where you can reflect and look at weighing out whether things are going well or as well as you would like. And when you immediately put that question to yourself, the answer is always going to be, hey, there could be more. It's just an inevitability, the difference between the ideal and reality. The ideal is always, always the sublime. It's the product of imagination. It's an intelligence. So to put that question there, know that it is raising a challenge for yourself, and in the back, it does look at options. Is there a way that I can, you know, make things a little better from, or I can I somehow enrich this kind of experience? Although in our minds, we rarely use that kind of language. If you have had that experience where your nose is pressed up against the glass and you're looking inside at others that seem to be doing just, you know, tremendous and enjoying it every way, and begin to reflect and think, what's the difference between me and that situation? Well, you could get it, you know, you could do yourself a favor and try and answer that question. Well, my goodness, masonry has been doing that kind of thing for a long, 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 long time for men and with men. Because we're not always brought up with on the knee of Plato or Socrates or Confucius. We're not. Most of us get by with the slings and arrows of misfortune and whatever circumstance may bring and provide. Equality? No, that's a construct. That's something that we aren't born equal. We are born into struggle, and what we have is opportunity, and you know, simplifying a great deal to say that life is what we make of it, because that's not always the everybody doesn't have access to that kind of thinking or opportunity, truly. But along comes masonry, masonry. If only masonry were mechanics, we'd be sending out the pamphlets and spreading the word around the globe. But religions tried to do that, didn't they? That's their turf. We're not a religion. We're something else. It's harder to, it's been for a lot of folks difficult to understand. And when I look around lodges, I think, well, there's a need to at least talk about this. What is it that we're up to? And I believe that what I'm seeing, what we're seeing, is the sense of having made something much more complicated than it need be. Much, much more complicated. It's already complicated enough. It's already fascinating enough. It stretches the imagination enough for us to be thinking that we have to add to that. That's a bit, let's say politely, that it's a bit naive. Where did that come from, that we think had this notion that masonry needed to be just a little more of a challenge? Maybe we could just do that on a personal level, couldn't we? I was one of those folks that was struck by some simple things. You know, I noticed the details. Honestly, and at a price, I will say. Not that I want to get into that, but noticing the detail, aude vide tace. I didn't start at the bottom of the page. I looked at it and right off the bat wondered, what in the world are these guys up to? And I began to, you know, what is it and why and how? And, well, it's beautiful. And where does it come from? All those kind of questions. Nobody made me do that. No. You get mocked for doing that kind of thing. But nobody makes you do it. You do it because it's there. And you wonder why it's there. Why are those words, the Greek words, so important that they're put together in a motto? Well, once you learn about it, gentlemen, as brethren out there listening to me will know, the worth and the value is self-evident. But it's so beautiful to think that even that kind of knowledge is left for somebody to probe. You need to be able to ask the question. And if you don't ask the question, that's not considered a crime or a sin. It's just, it is what it is. Information that can be released when there's a question. The question really provides that context and relevance. And what I've had is a lot of well-intended, energetic efforts or organized efforts to take that up for me, to teach me things without the question. In other words, telling me some ideas, putting out some ideas that are considered in my best interest, in my development, without ever explaining why or how. Well, those things are kind of important, unless you're lost in some, educational fetish where you're thinking that you can just jam ideas in rote fashion at somebody and make them smarter. Well, I think when that was in the 20s, we had those experiments would make genius children, and didn't last. Taught lots of tricks that made children appear quite remarkable. But as soon as they reached that age where they were growing up, they reverted to normal. And then ethicists moved in and made sure that kind of stuff didn't happen to other children. Like, my Lord, can you imagine? Brainwashing. Well, so we come along here. Masonry has always been, the clearer version. It's always been a point of view. And we know you by the way that your manner. The depth. Well, a Mason, we're told that a Mason is knowledgeable. Well, were you expecting that somebody was, of course, you're ridiculous. Nobody's going to expect to spoon feed education. I don't know. Do you get spoon fed metallurgy? Do you get spoon fed carpentry? Do you have to experience it and learn the skills yourself? How about engineering or medicine or law? Is that, can you imagine? Tort law, by the way, that's spoon fed to you. I laugh with my lawyer friends out there, not at you. No, I've had friends go through the, and how many careers in law were ended because of tort, anyway. I digress pleasantly, I must say. what recharges your point of view, that well-being? You bring all of that to Masonry when you come day one. Now, the idea is that somebody's whispering in your ear, we can help you develop your thinking. And by the way, it's not going to be spoon fed. It's provided to you symbolically, metaphorically, through allegory. All the things that somebody who's knows or literature or has been exposed to literature will already appreciate. But I'm not really, Masonry doesn't do well with schoolboys who have thought that anything about knowledge has to be a chore and they have to be tasked, that there can be no joy in finding science or mathematics or history. In fact, I have an old fellow, when he sees me, reminds me how much he adamantly hates history. The psychology of that is kind of a wonder. No one hates history, but saying that, it's just too tempting, but we'll let that go. Where do we get the idea that our learning is dependent on some underpaid, stressed out teacher with a lesson sheet? And if you don't have that around, you don't have that structure around you, learning doesn't happen. Well, the fortunate some people are intelligent enough to realize that, even from an early age, and go on and pursue as if the adults are not in charge of their learning, as if they are. And those are, you meet them, children that are enormously self-aware. We don't necessarily in our media make that popular. We, for a lot of reasons, that's the stuff that we should talk about another day. But for us, we have this these opportunities to be focused, to actually develop ourselves according to our own, to control our will, to achieve a different understanding of some of these propositions. Instead of guessing, do you want to know, truly know, and are you feeling that you are worth the effort to take control of your own learning? It's kind of a simple kind of a question. The clubbers in the crowd won't find this at all interesting, but we dress well and we have certain mannerisms that are pretty easy to adapt, if not more revealing for what we don't know. There is that quiet confidence that comes, but imagine living in a world where you're comfortable with understatement, where you're able to see the connections with other people and have a sense of being able to read another person and actually be a positive influence. Most often what that means is removing our own handcuffs, removing the limitations we place on ourselves. The things that we tend to do seem for a lot to fall by default, and we make assumptions. People are bad, people are angry and mean and untrustworthy. Which is an interesting and often spoken belief, an opinion. But if you stack it up with the facts, and believe me, studies have been done on this, of course, because it's a very important kind of a notion, you find that the facts don't agree. The facts don't agree. The media might not like to know, the few oligarchs in charge of newspaper or now internet and social media, they know that something salacious will sell faster, and they can get more money than talking about something more soothing and encouraging. They know that. You could create this entire mindset that anything that is learning is for geeks. It's something to be mocked, and it's not for you because you're not one of them. You're not one of the privileged few. So stay on the outside with your nose pressed up against that glass. Masonry shattered that glass and said, "Hey, wait. Form your own ideas." And what do you think about people that will be trying to shape your thinking? Critical thought. And instead of everything coming out, everything new is good, everything new, let's examine it. This is a great idea. Yeah, I'll examine it and get back to you. That kind of thinking. We have a good show today, I think. To be convinced of purpose. That's an interesting narrative. But we'll get into the music and the history and some poetry. And today we're going to walk into darkness, the poetry of Aleister Crowley. Yep, finally. So as we sit here bursting into flames, enjoy. It's a pleasure to have you sitting in with us today. There's a, I don't know, there's a charm to the work of Art Blakey. I understand he's an, he has the reputation of being an enormously beautiful and generous man and a talented musician, my goodness. Yeah, we have, today I thought I wanted to reflect just briefly on ideas of purpose, and as you are out there taking this in whatever setting, I hope you pour yourself a nice espresso, or if it's morning you have a cappuccino. Or that glass of wine that you've been waiting for all day. And perhaps just be a little bit, you know, a little bit more reflective of purpose. See how this fits with your thinking and what this does to you. And I apologize here. The other side of this conversation would be to wait and ask you, you know, put the question to you, but I'll assume that you have wonderful opinions on this. I never wanted to admit even a passing curiosity about Alistair. Sensuality was beyond good taste. Occult was a violation of my safely prescribed world. And yet, as bizarre as he seemed, Alistair defined a boundary of sorts. I can't help but think he manipulated sensationalism. He had intelligence, but played the bad boy beyond good taste. His explorations took him into Freemasonry, as it still does today, drawing men intent on finding new truths, code for studying the dark arts. When I speak with a Wiccan, I don't smell brimstone. My soul isn't scorched. My faith is no less or more than what it was before we spoke. I'm inclined to notice it converges nicely with pantheism. It subdues me when the suppression of female-led religion is explained. I must admit. And it's less puzzling that it is on the rise. Yeah. These old pre-Christian, or the Christian came up, Christianity came up with a beautiful word, pagan, you know, to describe it. But that notion of pre-Christian cultures and is experiencing a resurgence. It's not for the first time in history, but as long as people find solace in their faith, who am I to be doubting? Freemasonry is an interesting footnote. It's not a religion. A faith or a belief, it is that perspective. It's a perspective that, you know, is comfortable with a man's beliefs and values. But it's comfortable to a point, because it expects us to learn how to do the math ourselves, how to do the calculations, to know that what we are doing is ethical or not. The too easy to fall into ideological traps. You know, this is the way it is because it is the way it is. As long as people find solace, and that's important. In the future, Freemasonry may tell people about me and you without them knowing anything more about us. I'd like to think, before we're defined like that, that we've practiced in good faith the arts and sciences and been an influence of good as a result. As for Alistair, he still defines boundaries. He's still mocked, which tells us there is more to this fellow than meets the eye. Evil, malicious. I'll have to let you know. But more like a carny, you know, more like a talk show host than a threat. Although it did him, he had great press when somebody called him the greatest evilness. I wonder if he even came up with that himself, a little breath. I'm sorry, I'd like to be more threatening and menacing with this whole topic, but really, there's many more serious things that we could be talking about that would occupy our attention. Hmm? Wow. I know. Yeah, Joshua Redman. Check him out. Any of you need to take a moment and go and refill your glass? By all means, next time, keep it handy. There are today, we're closing in on 8 billion people in the planet. It's bringing up, you know, some of the lingering old wives' tales and things that were just so misguided. One of them that we don't like the science that disproves this is that the world is running out of space, and we don't have enough to feed everybody. So we ought to be limiting the population. Well, the math doesn't support the thinking, that kind of a statement at all. But that doesn't stop us for a lot of reasons. You can imagine the reasons on your own. We don't need to get into them. Not always healthy. But eugenics was popular back in the turn of this, in the early 1900s. Every so often it pops its head up again, you know, as if some despot has discovered that, you know, they can take meanness and psychopathology to a new level and start destroying people, you know. The world, we have our own, the world populations are experiencing limits, whether well beyond the likes of you and me, well beyond any kind of so-called military power. Right now, one of them is taking over. 100 million people have been displaced. It's considered the greatest displacement that's ever occurred in human history. Yeah, I think that it's going to have a bearing on us. Of course, how could it not? What this will do to food chains is going to be exciting. The that sense of opulence and indulgence, it's going to be tested. And oh my goodness, you can imagine this will be very uncomfortable, because we'll have to make do and share. And now we're seeing the effects. We're learning more about that we are in a global community. So what's happening, strife in one part of the world is going to affect the distribution of wheat, a staple for a lot of people. So times are recycling in a way and changing for new generations, next generations are expecting more and better, as well they should, as well they should. And we're seeing media being dealing with, painfully having to deal with cognitive dissonance. It's playing out, and it's exquisite. It's exquisite. Not fun. Not fun. The world around is we have these pop-ups, or, you know, I guess somebody's going to do something tragic to try and gain their moment of glory. And I wonder if this poet, I hail, you know, I revere poets because of their attention to detail and their courage. It's that artistry. When a dancer takes the stage, or a singer steps up, when the aria sweeps us all away emotionally, as it has since it was written, I admire that kind of courage tremendously, tremendously. And I admire the quiet heroes. These are people that do noble life-saving acts every single day and are not noticed. They don't have noisy big machines and weaponry around them. They're just saving lives and reducing pain and suffering, and they're the people that I admire most. They're around me, and no, they don't like to be thrown out into the limelight. Nope, that's what some of the things, you know, these are folks of character, and it makes you feel good about doing the same, not bragging about every little exploit. Certainly these aren't people that are going to take a picture of their breakfast and think that anybody else in the world is going to care to look at it. No, these are. But this guy is the guy we're going to talk about today. This is Aleister Crowley, the Edward Alexander Crowley. He was born the 12th of October, 1875. Fairly well off, you know. He was an heir to a brewing fortune, and then he went on to become an evangelist for the Plymouth Brethren. It's nonconformist religious denomination. I know, shocking. He was a nonconformist from an early age, and then, of course, again shocking, he had developed an aversion for Christianity early in life. But he was a student at Trinity College, so he had a Cambridge. So he was smart enough. Smart enough doesn't tame personality. You know, it really doesn't. And he began to use, he changed his name. He began, instead of Alexander, he went by Aleister, and gained a reputation as a smart guy. His skill was chess. So, you know, he knew his stuff. 1898, he left school without taking his degree. And his own inheritance left him free to travel. And he was, entitled, kind of a brat, I would think. But he started writing, and his first book of poetry came out that year, 1898. And then a number of books came after. Of course, the guy was a mountaineer. Hey? We know this guy. We see him on ads, all bronzed and coiffed, on the top of Kilimanjaro. While the science shows tell us about the degradation of the mountain and how it's, you know, it's become commercialized and all of that, there's still those that will shoot the biggest animal and take the trophy. And it's like wives or trophies, and climbing the highest is an accomplishment. And as I've often said to my blind friends, how much they make me look bad. Blind guys climbing mountains, I admire that. Blind guys playing better golf than me, ugh. Blind guys driving cars, we won't get into that. That was youthful experimentation. Nobody died. But his climbing career came to an abrupt end. It was marred. It was tragedy. Four of his climbers were killed in an avalanche. And it was reported that Crowley had advised them against taking the fatal road. He said, no, if you go there, that's dangerous. And he ignored their cries for help from the survivors of the accident. That sounds a bit extreme or embellished, but it, like many other skeptics, calling him a religious skeptic, I think, is a kindness. He became interested in occultism, occultism is just practices involving a belief in knowledge or use of supernatural forces or beings, and, you know, principally magical or divinatory. And they've occurred in all human societies throughout recorded history. Mm-hmm. And they center presumably on an ability of the practitioner to manipulate natural laws for their own or their client's belief. And such practices, it is said, tend to be regarded as evil only when they also involve the breaking of moral laws. Some anthropologists have argued that it's not possible to make a clear-cut distinction between magical, a principal component of occultism, and religion. And this may well be true of the religious systems of some non-literate societies. But there are aspects of occultism that appear to be common in all. Divination, magic, witchcraft, and alchemy are all treated in depth, you know, but they're also within that framework of occultism. Here we have our own, you know, Western tradition, Eastern tradition, of course. It's popularly conceived as a secret philosophy underlying all occult practices. So, well, who is not going to want to know more about that, I say? Well, I've met people that have taken this on seriously, and they are remarkably beautiful people. They're beautiful thinkers. I've met people that have studied the Kabbalah and the Kabbalistic tradition in there. And these are folks we'll know as this hermits, you know. It's fascinating, their understanding and what they bring to the conversation. This is this guy. He was in that company, but he was doing things a bit more outrageous. Hmm? A bit more outrageous. The stories he bought a place. He started his own religion, Thelemism, I think it was called, Thelemism, and everything was fine until it went too far and somebody died. A young man died. And then the knucklehead was truly dragged out and publicly ridiculed. And he died in like that, died in obscurity. He went through all his wealth, you know, it was one of those, and died poor in 1947. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, but you know, he may be bigger than life now, because you know he's shown up. The some rock musician bought his house. His face showed up on a Beatles album. You know, that kind of thing. Who is this weird guy? His strangeness. For learned men to be frightened of this guy? No. Here's his short poem called Pentagram. And we don't have the pleasure, I guess, of meeting the man. But this might reveal more about him if one poem by this fellow, wrote quite a bit, would reveal all. But let's see what let's see what it tells us. In the years, this is called the pentagram, in the years of the primal course, in the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horse, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an hollow skin from the heart of an holy tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigor of steam. He harnessed the lightning for hire. He drove the celestial team, and man was the lord of the fire. Deep mouthed from their thrones, deep seated, the choirs of the Aeons declare, the last of the demons defeated, for man is the lord of the air. Arise, O man, in thy strength. The kingdom is thine to inherit. Till the high gods witness at length that man is the lord of his spirit. He was an interesting guy, wasn't he? He was an interesting guy. He picked up on a notion that to be free, you would follow will. Whatever you will is fine. That's the what broke the moral code was inserting this notion that you follow what's natural to you is that sense of what satisfies your will, and your purpose on earth is to follow your own will. No, not really going to fit well. He was a Mason, huh? You know, he's a smooth talker, but in fact, our work is our scaffolding, our framework is pretty much to control, not to indulge, to control will, have command of will, not to be subject to it. So we weren't on the same page with this fellow. Not to say he wasn't interesting, you know, studied sorcery and the Torah, and he was an interesting man, but does that give us anything more about the man? Does it to reveal this notion of who of the point that Aleister Crowley was trying to make? I don't know. I'm not satisfied myself that we know much about him, because I'm not so sure there was much to know. The silliness aside and the extreme views, well, you've met that kind of guy somewhere along the line. Being shocking doesn't, you know, you've met the people that are shocking for the sake of shock. And yeah, some art is like that. But then when you get around it, it's like, what are you saying? What's the message you're trying to communicate here? That there is shock in the world? Yeah, got it. And now what? And I mean this, without trying to be coy about it. Maybe it's my homage to Aleister Crowley, Dexter Gordon, Cry Me a River. Thank you. Dexter Gordon, just fabulous, fabulous. We're going to talk a bit about social tensions and the relationship of our order to that. Don't do this as a mean to sensationalize the show. Far from it. You guys know better than that. You people know better than that. I hope. But it happens. And the part that if this was happening around us, if we were talking about how we have social tensions going on around us today, but they would be a hot button item to bring up, wouldn't they? And unless we have some, agreed upon rules of decorum where we could talk without somebody flipping out and carrying on and being silly with their, trying to be forceful or proselytize. Oh, my Lord. No, that we would listen and have a sensible conversation. Something moderated. Well, this is time allows us to do that. Puts distance and time, that notion that I have no clue how to describe that to you, but I have an understanding of time and space and, distance and time. So do you, I think. And maybe it is, will emerge from that vagueness one day where we become a little closer. As we get a little closer to the end of our time, we begin to reflect on end of what? End of this, end of that, end of different dimensions. Too tempting, but not for now. We've talked about what's been going on in Amsterdam and the struggle here was more, this is, we were talking about a very renowned lodge, Le Bien Ami, and its struggles, because they kept careful documents for us. Thank you very much. And we're looking at a comparative understanding of history. What's going on with the ideas of Masonry in settings outside of the UK? Well, certainly the UK had a bearing. And what we were looking at brings up in the earliest records of these reconstituted lodges, the concern is more with legitimacy than with behavior. Now, I can't imagine the what it would be like if we had no defined rules or boundaries, so that you and I and a band of our rowdy friends could say, right, we're going to start our own. Nothing's to stop us. We'll start our own ritual. We'll have our own order. We'll name it as we do. We'll have dues. We'll be selective. In other words, we'll mirror everything about Freemasonry, but we'll call it our own. And in fact, we know that there were people that would go around to remote lodges. This is taking advantage of this gap in communication that we often bitch about today. But because the news traveled very slowly, they could go around town to town offering to sell for certain fees, the newest Masonic degree. These were just snake oil salesmen. They were making them up and selling them. And naive, well-intentioned Masons would say, right, I'll have, I'm good for that. How many guineas there? And this went on until we had to wisen up to our vulnerability. And how would we be able to stop it? Well, we see that today. We put in certain safeguards. And yes, unless we know the backstory, we can mistakenly assume that this is arbitrary, but it isn't. Certainly not. There's a story behind it. One would think that you would be exposed to this idea with the backstory too. But where I am, the bottom of the page has been clipped off far, far too often. So you're left with the outcome without the explanation. Now, this is let me just read to you just a piece here about the Higgs. Some English brethren, we're dealing with Dutch merchants here, and they met in Carousel Lodge with some English brethren. And the English brethren, the legitimacy of the English brethren was sought from the Higgs. What the demand was for some proof, a copy of the Constitution. They were getting to that point because they were fed up with charlatans and intrusions. And as the letter of their Amsterdam brothers makes clear, a new lodge, however distant, could be established at will with brothers filling the office by a simple election. But the legitimacy of the lodge, a matter separate from its creation, require recognition from other constitutionally established lodges. It is worth noting, if only in passing, that the establishment of the lodge in Carousel was not without controversy. The description of that process makes reference to the slander through sects that threatened to embitter the opening of our temple of decent amusement. As we saw with the lodge of Nijmegen, the slander suggests the possibility of accusations of sodomy against the exclusively male fraternity. The topic must await. We'll discuss that later. But the reference, once again, reminds us of the range of social tensions that Masonic fraternity could arouse. To prevent these tensions spilling into the lodge in Amsterdam, as elsewhere, new brothers were admitted by election, but with an overwhelming majority, near unanimity, required for admission. Unanimous, it had to be unanimous. The process of profoundly social and personal was candidates for admission were invariably described as honest men possessing the character and the morals and the discretion of which there can be no reproach, such that they may aspire to the advantage of being initiated into our mysteries. Men had to be local or known well by brothers who were local. Men could be and were rejected. As the orator once said, the principles of our institution, the philanthropy, the charity, and the sweet primitive equality of all men which is the foundation of our art is what we seek to establish in our hearts and well as in our assemblies. In the new public space which the Lodge created, brothers promised unanimously to correct our conduct. The public outside the Lodge judges morality only by appearances. The world is a place of prejudice and caprice. The Freemasons know that morality is inseparable from virtue. And the good company of my brothers is always the necessary condition of morality. You dictate in detail the duties of society. Morality and virtue are inseparable from social experience. They are social experience. But as Schroeder put it, the external displays of civility so important in the lodges reveal the internal civility of a man. Don't fake it. Charity is at the heart of civility, a person caring of each brother one for the other. And the lodge permits that experience among men carefully chosen by their peers, governed strictly by the rules of the order, sequestered from the world, obedient to their master as friends, citizens, and brothers. In the sacred temple of Freemasonry, brothers will find a true liberty, a true peace. Different today, not much, except when you were thinking about those oaths, now we have a sense of what it is we were promising, the history. We were promising a certain level of conduct. My goodness, whoever explained that to you? So let me see, put this question to you. It's puzzled me. A fellow carries on and is belligerent and is thrifty with his manners. And I see that he has never been taught. How am I to judge that behavior? Oh, and get over this sense that we don't judge. Come on. We have the chair of Solomon. So the question remains, help me with that. Help me with that. Whew, it's fun, eh? Well, there we have another episode of Masonic Effects. And I hope that it has stimulated the thinking and encouraged you. You are the source of learning. If I'm going to teach you or try to teach or attempt to teach you anything, you need to know you are the expert. My goodness, you are. Don't feel that it's an affront. I read different things than you do. I have different activities than you do. For either one of us to think that one is better than the other is absurd. Absurdity is beneath us. Wasting each other's time, wasting our own time in life, that's beneath us. I have no pleasure in that. In fact, I think you and I, if we tolerated that, we could find the camaraderie, being decent fellows. We can find camaraderie in most bars. We just sidle up to the bar stool And we can find loose conversation and thoughtless opinion all around us and laugh about it. But if that's not getting you anywhere, or there's, you find that that's like a life without much meaning, you know, you go back there every night, you're made to feel, you have this temporary sense that you're important and life is beautiful. Well, that's a different kind of life than what Masonry has been building. Knowing the truth about things, it means knowing disappointment. But, and this is an important but, knowing the truth and understanding the disappointment is better than being ignorant. And if a guy can't come to terms with that, he needs to simply find a place by the shore, drag out a nice bottle of Merlot, and watch the sunrise. Watch the sunrise, because people like me think you deserve better, and that you're capable of far, far more. Well, the world doesn't stop, it doesn't, because we're seeing disappointment for what it is, because we see life what it is. It certainly doesn't. You don't have a sense of humor, you don't have a sense of perspective, but you're that kind of, you might want to re-examine that kind of fragility there, mate. Especially if you support the kind of sports teams that the likes of me support, you need to be thick-skinned lately, I'll tell you. Anyway, enough of that. I'm so pleased that you took the time to share a bit of it with us here. And I hope this has been informative and entertaining and satisfying in some ways. And I look forward to having you sit in with us next week on Masonic Effects. Thanks.